Support for this public radio podcast comes from the Society for Human Resource Management, which also sponsors PBS's CEO Exchange, online at shrm.org. And by Cargill, collaborate, create, succeed. This is how Cargill works with customers. Stories online at cargillcreates.com. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937, Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Of all the groups out there that offer economic statistics, we would be hard-pressed to find one more opaque than the Institute for Supply Management. For one thing, what does that even mean, the Institute for Supply Management? And for another, why does everybody pay so much attention to what they say? Well, maybe because what they said today sounds a whole lot like recession. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Grant Thornton, dedicated to serving their clients worldwide with a passion for the business of accounting. On the web at grantthornton.com. Marketplace Entrepreneurship Reporting is supported by Lenovo, official computer partner of the Olympic Games. Lenovo dedicates 1% of income to support entrepreneurship and social ventures worldwide.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is February 5th today, Tuesday, a super one, and it's good to have you here. In a very small nutshell, the Institute for Supply Management describes itself this way. They are the ones who keep track of resources, logistics, everything you need to make an organization tick. It's also got some economists on staff, though, and their work is what had everybody reeling today. The ISM comes out every month with two reports. One tracks the manufacturing sector. Another tracks the service part of the economy and whether or not they're growing. The service side is most distinctly not. Today's report showed service industries drew back last quarter by a big chunk. Now, if ever there was an economic report that needed explaining, I would say this is it. And Marketplace's Bob Moon is here to do just that. Hey, Bob.
Hello, Kai.
You know, we don't talk about the service economy too much on the program, but this is a serious number, and it's a very big deal today.
It is. You know, once upon a time, we were a country of workers who manufactured things or built things or turned out crops or produced raw materials. But all that evolved over the second half of the last century, and our economy is now overwhelmingly made up of workers who offer services. In fact, this is a sector that these days makes up no less than 90% of the economy. So that's why this number in particular is so significant and so worrisome on Wall Street. We've got financial services, legal services, computer, health, educational, retail services, even the entertainment industry. And I guess you could say that you and I fall into that category of providing some kind of service here. You think about it, a big share of the workers in a lot of the biggest corporations in this country are contract workers, or they come from small vendors, from specialized services. So that gives you an idea of why the financial markets took a very close look at this report today and shuddered.
All right, here's another group of service workers, economists, right? They keep track of these things. They're supposed to know what's coming. Mm-hmm. And yet, last week's unemployment report caught them off guard, and today's number as well caught them off guard.
Yeah, the general consensus was for this index to fall to around 52. Now, keep in mind, 50 is the dividing line between growth and contraction here. And last month, it fell to 42 from 54 the prior month. So it was a big, big drop.
Is it now official? Can we finally get off the fence and say, hey, bam, we're in a recession?
Yeah, I get the impression you'd like that.
Well, a little clarity would be nice.
Yeah, it would be. It does make our job easier if we can talk about something that's really happening. Well, guess what? There's still more guesswork ahead here. I spoke to economist Ken Malin today at Clearview Economics. I pushed him really hard on this recession question. Hey, the number now says the service sector is contracting. What more of an indication do you need? Well, as economists often do, he had one of those other hands.
One thing that's holding me back from making the recession call is the fact that the manufacturing number, which was in a decline state for the month of December, actually bounced back in January to come up above the 50 level, indicative of manufacturing advancing rather than declining.
So there you go. Maybe we're almost certainly looking at a recession.
Yeah, maybe, certainly. Listen, one source does not a story make, though. What are other people saying?
We heard something similar today from the president of the Richmond Federal Reserve Bank, Jeffrey Lacker. He told a group of bankers in West Virginia he sees sluggish growth in the first half of the year, a recovery in the second half, but he says he can also see the possibility of a mild recession.
Let's get to the parent organization of the Richmond Fed, Ben Bernanke and the rest of the big kahunas in Washington. What are they going to do now about interest rates and the whole thing?
Well, I can tell you how the market is betting right now. The market is betting that the Fed is going to cut its benchmark rate by another half a percentage point at or maybe even before their scheduled meeting in March.
Here we go again. Marketplace's Bob Moon. Thank you, Bob.
Thanks, Kai.
It's not just our service sector that's going south. Europe's equivalent of the ISM released its numbers today as well. Same story there. In part, that's why the dollar came out ahead for the day, up about a percent or so against the euro. Standard & Poor's stated the glaringly obvious today. It said a stumble among bond insurance companies could make things even more shaky in the financial markets. Some of the blame for the subprime mess can be fairly laid at the feet of ratings companies like S&P and Moody's. For decades, they rated only Treasury and municipal bonds. The higher the rating, the more confidence investors tend to have in the quality of the bonds. But they've also given some mortgage-backed bonds some pretty high ratings, too, even, as we now know, when they weren't deserved. So both Moody's and Fitch are thinking about overhauling their rating system to restore confidence in what it is that they do. Ashley Miltite reports.
The agencies aren't concerned about their rating systems for regular bonds and loans. They're focusing on revamping ratings for complex financial instruments like mortgage-backed securities. Walter O'Hare of consultancy firm Celent says any fix won't address one of investors' biggest issues, that the agencies are still paid by the companies whose products they rate.
The perception is if the issuer is paying for the rating, that may bias the rating agency to view the potential risk a little more favorably.
There's a lot of money involved. CNBC says nearly half of Moody's revenue in 2006 came from rating these complicated securities. Bert Ely is a banking consultant. He says it's not only the agency's built-in conflict of interest that presents a problem for investors.
People place too much reliance on these ratings, period.
He says at least with regular bonds, investors can do their own research. But securities like collateralized debt obligations are hard enough to pronounce. Understanding them is even more challenging, so most people look straight to the ratings, and that's a mistake.
One of the things that has come out in recent weeks is the extent to which the rating agencies did not understand the risk, in part because they were not given all of the information they should have had.
That could be partly why Moody's is considering adding warning labels to its ratings. Celent's Walter O'Hare says measures like this by the agencies may not be enough to restore investors' trust.
Yes, they can tighten up their processes themselves, and yes, they can apply further diligence in doing what they do, but they're just part of a larger process.
A process that led to far too many people getting mortgages they couldn't afford. I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
Toyota reported this morning that its profits rose despite a slump in North American sales. The world's number two car maker saw a 7.5% bump in profits. Back home, five Chrysler plants got back to work today. The privately held company reached a tentative deal with one of its parts suppliers. Chrysler had shut those plants down over the weekend after the supplier, a company named Plastec, filed for bankruptcy. But Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports the agreement might just be a brief turn in the road.
Last year, Plastec's customers, including Chrysler, Ford, and GM, came up with a $46 million bailout to keep the struggling parts supplier in business. Last Friday, with Plastec still struggling, Chrysler decided it wanted out. Plastec immediately suspended part shipments to Chrysler and filed for bankruptcy. Global Insight auto analyst Aaron Bragman says Chrysler's move was a surprise.
Ending a contract like this is the last resort in terms of any negotiations with your suppliers. Unless you have everything already set up and ready to go at competitors, suppliers, and in Chrysler's case, when you're talking about 500 parts for just about every one of their cars and 14 plants, it doesn't look like they were prepared to do that at all.
Bragman says all of Plastec's customers are looking for a more reliable supplier. But he thinks Chrysler acted first because it's a privately owned company that wants to avoid future bailouts.
Chrysler does have options that a public company would not. They're able to take on a little bit more pain in terms of these kinds of relationships without having the public investors coming knocking at their door. It's simply the board that's really calling the shots on this.
Chrysler's deal with Plastek runs out February 15th. Chrysler spokeswoman Michelle Tinson says the company is looking for alternatives.
However, we have a court hearing that's in litigation now that would be occurring on February 13th, and that will determine the next steps.
But analysts say it could take weeks, if not months, for Chrysler to find a replacement for Plastek. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Today was the worst day in the markets yet in an already lousy year, mostly because nobody much cared for that service sector report Bob Moon was explaining to us. We will have the details when we do the numbers. Airline passengers are no strangers to being nickel and dimed at 35,000 feet. You want food with your flight? That'll cost you. More legroom? It's yours for a fee. Checking a second bag, perhaps. Just yesterday, United said sure for $25 each way. But JetBlue and Kraft Foods have found a way to take advantage of a captive audience for free. For the next month, passengers are going to be guinea pigs for Kraft's new low-fat cream cheese. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler has the skinny.
Kraft is giving away 500,000 breakfasts on JetBlue flights. The company sent along two employees to hand out bagels and talk up Kraft's new Philadelphia one-third less fat cream cheese.
It's hard to miss a couple of guys in white tuxedos talking to you on a plane. It's definitely a conversation starter.
That's Tyler Williamson, a brand manager at Kraft Foods. This week, he's flying all over the country to generate buzz about the low-fat cream cheese.
9 out of 10 people are absolutely skeptical and not willing to accept that a light product can taste just as good as a regular product.
Williamson won't comment on how much, if anything, Kraft paid JetBlue, but he says handing out samples on a flight that offers no meals is a low-cost way to get people to try a new product. Airports were once a good place to market products to people waiting for flights. Security concerns have put an end to that. Marketing professor Peter Boatwright at Carnegie Mellon University says targeting potential customers in the air makes sense.
Having a captive audience on an airplane, maybe that audience will feel that they have at least 5 minutes of disposable time to ponder the new cream cheese flavor and respond to it.
Boatwright says people who help test a product are more likely to buy it. He considers the in-flight marketing to be a good idea, but only if it remains novel.
If we get so many market research firms doing test marketing on airplanes, it'll get mundane pretty soon.
If that happens, consumers will tune out, no matter how many calories are at stake. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Let's redirect the high-tech conversation away from Microsoft and Yahoo for a second here. Time Warner releases quarterly earnings tomorrow, which will probably mean more talk about the future of America Online. You remember how Time Warner used to call itself AOL Time Warner? Well, AOL's fallen on harder times since then, but it's always going to have a place in Internet history, as much for itself as for its role with another company from pre-dot-com boom days. It owns Netscape. At the end of this month, AOL is going to pull the plug on the once ubiquitous browser. But Netscape's got a backstory that's worth remembering, as Marketplace's Lisa Napoli reports.
Once upon a time, about 13 years ago, the only way most of us could get online was by subscribing to something called a closed proprietary online service. There wasn't a whole lot you could do on these services. You couldn't even send email to someone who wasn't on the same one as you. Mark Benaroff was an executive at two early online companies. He remembers the first time he saw this new thing called a web browser. Its name was Netscape.
And you could tell it was, you know, really the beginning of the dam breaking. Everyone was going to be on the same roadway system, the same interstate system.
Netscape was a whole new way of going online, getting on to the internet. Back then, not many people understood or cared what that meant. And yet, on August 9, 1995, when Netscape went public, it created a frenzy. The offering price doubled even before the opening bell, from $14 to $28. Then it hit an unthinkable $75 a share. Ted Leonsis paid close attention. He was a co-founder of America Online, the competition.
And then we just watched it throughout the day go up and up and up and up. And I remember so clearly the euphoria and rush. We had never seen a phenomenon like that.
Netscape's stunning debut made Wall Street hungry for more. The words initial public offering became part of the zeitgeist. People who'd never bought stock before started sinking all their money into any internet-related company they could. Anyone with an idea for the next big thing could attract millions of dollars in venture capital. But perhaps the biggest thing Netscape did, it made everyone aware of this newfangled thing called the World Wide Web.
Oh, it was the first modern dot-com.
That's Mark Weber of the Web History Project. He says pre-Netscape, the internet was a strange subterranean entity. Post-Netscape, it was a populist playground, a whole new economy.
Well, I think it'll be remembered as the company that made the web a commercial success and by extension really built the web that we know.
Netscape will also be remembered as a company that was trounced by software giant Microsoft. Its rival Internet Explorer overtook the desktop and led to a long antitrust battle between the two companies. America Online tried to rescue the pioneering browser company. It plunked down more than $4 billion for it in 1998. Ted Leonsis of AOL says it was too late.
We were unsuccessful in being able to battle Microsoft, as are most companies. You know, there were lots of lawsuits and lots of issues of monopoly bundling. You know, that's kind of ancient history now.
As is Netscape as of today. From a dominant market share and a critical role in the development of a modern medium to nothing more than a footnote. In Los Angeles, I'm Lisa Napoli for Marketplace.
Coming up, gambling on prediction. Smart move?
Or is it just a bunch of idiots and you put them together and, you know, their idiocy is magnified? I didn't really know how it would work, so I thought I'd give it a shot.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials closed down 2.9% today, 370 points, ended the day at 12,265. It was the worst point drop for the blue chip since last August. The Nasdaq crashed 3%, 73 points, to finish at 2309. The S&P 500 suffered its biggest loss in 11 months, 3.2%, 44 points, closed at 1336. All 30 Dow components were in the red today, but banks took the biggest hit by far. Recession fears pounded Citigroup. Investors punished shares of the financial giant more than 7%. Other financials didn't fare much better at all. Washington Mutual forfeited 5.5%. J.P. Morgan plunged 5%. Bonds jumped as investors sought a safe haven of some kind. The yield on the 10-year T-note ended the day at 3.57%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constellation Energy, working to provide responsible, sustainable energy to power America's future. Constellation Energy, the way energy works. Sustainability coverage supported by Calvert, mutual funds, college savings, and retirement investments in companies committed to responsible environmental, social, and governance practices. Calvert.com. Marketplace aims to be insightful and provocative. And if you send our stories along, you can be too. Log on to our website and forward any story you hear. Every day's rundown is there, along with transcripts of the show and links to individual pieces. It's at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Labor Department reports on fourth quarter productivity. Both the House and Senate Armed Services Committee hold hearings on the FY09 defense budget. And Christians around the world observe Ash Wednesday, the start of the 40-day season of Lent. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter.
If by some chance you've been living under a big, giant political rock, today is the big day. It's Super Tuesday. Californians are having the earliest primary we've ever had. Almost 9 million people are expected to vote out here today. If our commentator Jeffrey Anderson has anything to say about it, we'll be voting even earlier in 2012. Last week he said we ought to replace Iowa in the election calendar with California and have a state that really matters go first. At that, Melissa Owsley of Waterford, Michigan, picked up the phone and gave us a call.
Oh, Lord, a Californian.
She says Anderson's logic could be used by other states, too. In fact, it was.
It was the same reasoning that actually the Michigan legislators had for saying Michigan's primaries should be ahead of time. Of course, we got punished for it.
Michigan and Florida, you might remember, had their Democratic delegates yanked after they played with their primary calendar. A couple of weeks ago, we brought you the story of a music industry buyout gone bad. Last summer, Terra Firma bought the British recording company EMI. Thousands of jobs were cut, and many of the label's bands, both big and small, walked out as well. Band manager John Webster says the merger isn't the problem. An industry overrun with piracy is.
How do you compete with free?
Well, like this, according to Steve Warona of Rockville, Maryland.
How do you compete with free? Ask that with a straight face every time you pass a vending machine selling bottled water. How do you compete with free? You stop whining that it can't be done and start emulating the people who are doing it.
Last week brought us all another kind of free money from the economic stimulus package. Whatever version finally does pass Congress is going to contain rebate checks for those under certain income limits. Thomas Callahan of Macon, Georgia, said one thing in our reporting on that story struck him as a little odd.
David Weiss, chief economist of Standard & Poor's, said over and over again, I would like my check and think everyone else feels the same way. And I kept thinking to myself, what on earth is Standard & Poor's doing only paying their chief economist $75,000?
Truth be told, sir, he probably makes a little bit more money than that. Finally, though, a little travel news. Last week, new passport rules for entry at the Canadian and Mexican borders went into effect. Commentator Carrie Jacobs offered her thoughts that passport designers were up to no good when they covered the book with shots of Americana. Isabel Fleurot of Tucson, Arizona, said we forgot to mention the last page and its rendering of the moon.
I just became a U.S. citizen in April last year. For me, being, you know, coming from another country, I don't consider that the moon belongs to the United States.
If you hear something that strikes you as out of this world, go ahead and tell us about it. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. The political futures markets are busy today as people place their online bets for a particular candidate before the polls close. Prognostication is nothing new, of course, especially not in business. People make a whole lot of money trying to figure out which way a stock's going to go or whether a new company's going to hit it big or bomb. Now there's a company trying to make guessing itself into a business. Predictify.com lets you guess the outcome of sporting events, elections, even television shows. And there's some money to be made on the side. Marketplace's Sean Cole logged on.
So we go to Predictify.com.
And there are basically two buttons, ask and predict.
Click predict, and there's all these different questions, different categories, pop culture, politics.
I chose politics.
Which Democratic presidential candidate will Al Gore endorse?
All the questions are black and white like that. Multiple choice, yes or no.
Your prediction, I'll say Hillary Clinton.
And as I'm doing this, I'm thinking, wait, what do I know?
There's actually a fair amount of academic research supporting the concept of collective wisdom.
And this is Parker Barrill, co-founder of Predictify. He says there's a lot of knowledge in them thar internet users, and that crowds tend to average out at the right answer.
So the idea was, how can we harness that information in a way that really adds value?
Which is where the money comes in. Most Predictify users are in it just for fun, and there are no ads on the site. But some askers post premium questions. That is, they pay $1 for every response they get. In return, they get anonymous demographic information of all those answerers, age, race, etc. And not only that.
On premium questions, when Predictify collects a fee from the question asker, we then share a portion of that fee with the predictors based on their accuracy.
And how much money can I make on the site if I am guessing on a premium question and I get it right?
So last I checked, the highest payout to date had been, I think, $13.75.
Huh.
Some would say that's not a whole lot of money. Others would say there aren't a whole lot of places on the internet where you can make $13.75 for 1 minute of your time.
Meantime, some folks are using Predictify in place of expensive market research. And one of them is kind of famous.
You know, I was kind of wondering, does the crowd really have wisdom?
This is Scott Adams, the guy who created Dilbert.
Or is it just a bunch of idiots and you put them together and, you know, their idiocy is magnified? I didn't really know how it would work, so I thought I'd give it a shot.
In short, he paid $1 a response to ask how many copies of his new non-Dilbert book would be in print before the end of January. In the end, the crowd, about 1,300 people, predicted 406,857.280 copies. Adams says they way overshot.
And I suspect they're not right, but it shows a lot more optimism than I have about the book. And I think that the Predictify results kind of energized me. And so I think I put in a lot more hours in the publicity than I would have if I hadn't seen the Predictify estimates.
Other premium question askers have said the demographic information gives them a genuine business advantage. But Kathleen Siders, who teaches marketing at Boston College, says this demographic breakdown is too crude and stick figure-y, and that these kinds of answers don't tell you much.
It's incredibly limited because when we do marketing research, we typically want to find out what people's attitudes are, their perceptions, their intentions, their beliefs.
But there is one way Siders thinks Predictify can help marketers, not as research, but as actual marketing.
You're going to see savvy people start to post questions when they're really more interested in creating some kind of awareness of something.
It's an advertisement phrased as a question.
It's a promotional opportunity that doesn't look crass. And these are the kind of things that people and companies are looking for.
People like Scott Adams, who's way ahead of her on this one. He says his new book has been a little tougher to promote than usual.
Because I've got a problem with my voice.
A rare condition called spasmodic dysphonia.
So I was looking for ways that did not involve the traditional method of going out and giving speeches and talking to people in bookstores. So Predictify kind of worked perfectly into that idea.
Of course, if all you want to do is promote something on Predictify, there's nothing to stop you from posting a question for free. I'm Sean Cole for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a 529 plan can help meet your college savings goals. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, February is Girl Scout Cookie Month, and some more enterprising scouts are trying to make finding those cookies easier for you. In parts of Texas and Pennsylvania, they've launched an online cookie locator. All you have to do is type in your zip code. It'll tell you where to get your snacks. We'll have a link on our homepage for you, of course, but caveat emptor, because once you go to buy them, you might run into a saleswoman like 6-year-old Sierra Ochoa from Teaneck, New Jersey.
They cost $3.50. And we have peanut butter patties, and we have cinnamon, and we have...
That's $3.50, but what about the tag-alongs? I always really like the tag-alongs. Anyway, cookie-less, that is Marketplace from American Public Media on this Tuesday. Today, the Dow cleaved off 370 points, 2.9%. The NASDAQ sank 73 points, 3%. The S&P 500 lumbered down 44 points, 3.2%. Thanks to Renita Jablonski and Miguel Macias on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by John Buckley. Coming up next time on this program, your rainy day 401k fund might have sprung a leak.
What they haven't told you is that the underlying fund managers, those who are actually managing the investments, they charge a fee.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money.
Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.